So happy it's Thursday. Welcome, ESPN, 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. Happy to be back. Kind of dusting some of the cobwebs off. We've been gone for two weeks. 2 weeks. Basketball. Nobody on ESPN watches basketball, do they? They really cut into our airtime. But we are happy to be back in studio with us today, Justin Redgers. He is a CDFA and Managing Director of Pacific Divorce Management. Justin, welcome. And what is a CDFA?
Thanks for the welcome, Ryan. Thanks. Nice to be here, guys. CDFA stands for Certified Divorce Financial Analyst. It's a designation that a financial professional might gain if they're seeking to be able to help individuals, couples, families through the financial decisions in divorces.
I see. Okay. Another certification. Got it. And you are associated and you're a trustee for the MS Society here locally, right?
That's correct, yes. I'm a trustee of the Pacific South Coast chapter of the National MS Society, which represents San Diego and Orange and Imperial counties here in Southern California, as well as the state of Hawaii, helping 45,000 people, I believe is the number these days, who are living with or have loved ones living with multiple sclerosis.
And there's a golf tournament today?
No, not today.
The practice
round was today. Yeah, the tournament itself, I believe, is May 7th, the first Monday of May.
Got it.
Up
Got
at
it.
La Jolla Country Club.
Well, excellent. Thank you. And repeat offender, Sean Weber, the love doctor. Sean Weber is a family law attorney with Brave, Weber, and Mack. He specializes in the collaborative divorce, is one of the things we're here to talk about today, and how that's different than a traditional divorce, although you do the traditional divorce as well. But collaborative is one of the things that sets you apart.
If somebody needs to get divorced, I can help them do it any way they want. But collaborative is definitely one of the ways we do it, and it's one of the reasons I'm excited to be here with Justin.
Excellent. Well, we certainly will touch on that as well. So today, the topic is concerns for people contemplating a separation. And you guys have created a 20-point list of, I guess, would be the frequently asked questions or what people need to know when they're thinking about going through the process. That's what we're here to talk about, right?
That's what we're here
Absolutely.
For.
Sounds good.
Wow. 20 points. That's it? Seems like there should be more.
I think there are hundreds. We just are whittling it down to 20 for our purposes today.
Okay, good. Good, good. Well, we may not get through all of them, but we can go to your websites, which we'll certainly give out, and get that information out there. Now, are these in any particular order, like the biggest one first, or are we just kind of alphabetically?
I'd say that there's not any particular order. We can kind of help everybody understand what are the things in terms of what likely order you're going to have to make decisions when it comes to these things. But in terms of importance, the first thing that I think people need to understand is that they have options. That's the first thing. And collaborative divorce, as we already talked about with Sean a second ago, is one of those main options. Mediation, litigation. And Sean can enlighten everybody as to what the differences are from a legal perspective.
Well, so that's deciding on what process you're going to use to get a divorce. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, that's really key. I mean, one of the biggest decisions this a person can make in their life is whether or not they're going to get a divorce, take that step. Yeah. You know, and then the second decision they have to make once they've made that difficult decision is, how is my process going to go? How is this divorce going to be? Because it sets the tone, really, for what's my relationship going to be with my ex after.
So it's kind of like a flow chart. Basically, you sit down with a client and you say, here are the different options, one being collaborative. And then once you decide that that may be the path, because evidently it's maybe less expensive or less intrusive. I mean, what is the advantage of doing a collaborative divorce?
Well, you know, everybody's different. So not one process is a one size fits all. The thing about collaborative is that it gets you out of the courtroom. The attorneys actually sign an agreement that says they're never going to cross the threshold of the courtroom. And then we will work also with people on our team, with folks like Justin, who can serve as financial specialists on a team of professionals, or you can hire coaches who are mental health professionals who act as coaches to help with the mental health issues, or you could hire a child specialist. You build your team and you specialize it to the couple.
So you two are commonly a team then?
We would be part of a team in a collaborative process. Specifically, each party would have their own attorney. They would have a single financial professional such as myself that would work for both the husband and the wife. and they would each potentially have a mental health professional to help them work through communication and things of that nature. So it's a larger team, and each couple has the ability to kind of build that team based upon what their individual needs are.
Yeah, and you know, you asked whether it was more cost effective. I think it is, because you're not having to fight the battles at court. You're not doing the discovery in a traditional sense that you would in a litigated context, where you're doing depositions and all of that
discovery,
subpoenas, depositions. You're trying to discover what all the financial data is. But we do informal discovery, where we'll actually call the source and ask them to give us stuff, and they do. And that's one of the nice things about collaborative, is you can do things on a much more informal basis. And
is it the same? I mean, is the result the same? At the end, let's say that someone wasn't as collaborative as they may have come up to be, or forthright about their financials, and would there be an ability to go back, or is that something that doesn't happen? Or?
Well, for most people, the result is better, because you have all these professionals that they're working together and synergizing to come up with a plan that is more well thought out than anything a judge could do. You got to remember, when you go to court, you're one of hundreds and hundreds of people that the judge saw that week, and he's got a very limited amount of time to be able to make a decision about your case.
You've mentioned a couple times before as to how the attorneys that are involved in the collaborative divorce actually signed something saying, should this thing go to trial, you guys are not in the picture.
That's
so
right.
It's to be settled within itself right there.
That's the point of collaborative. That disqualification clause is what we call it, that we put into a stipulation that gets filed at court. The team members drop out of the case if the parties should choose to litigate.
And that allows people to express more openly in the collaborative process? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. One, it gives you an incentive to stay in the process, because you don't want to start over.
Right.
But what I think is actually the most important part of it is, at least from my perspective as an attorney, I've lost my need to have to posture all the time like I would in a litigated case.
Right.
And so now, instead of looking for who's going to win and who's going to get one better on the other person, I'm looking for solutions for this couple as they're facing this difficult
time. So what does that mean to posture?
Oh, I'm always thinking about, well, how can I spin this?
I see. So
for my client, to their benefit.
Right.
Now, I want to help my client, don't get me wrong. But the point is, when I'm doing the collaborative work, I don't have to constantly thinking about, well, am I going to say something that's going to be used against me in court? Do I want to, take some position that's like way in left field so that I can get a better outcome in the middle?
Well, you said earlier that you may be the one in 1,000 cases that the judge saw that week. It kind of sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is, with the collaborative divorce, you've seen and participated in thousands of divorces, and there is essentially almost this recipe for what is fair to divide the household. Is that something that happens within the collaborative divorce? Or?
Yeah, there's truth in what you're saying. A lot of times the professionals know where the settlement is before the parties know. But the point of the collaborative is, we want the parties to work harder than the professionals, because it's their case. We want them making the decisions, not us. And we'll help guide them. And they've got attorneys in the room, so they've got somebody who's got their back. They're not going to be allowed to – well, they're not going to be able to make stupid decisions without being advised. But in essence, you get a better outcome because you're in control. You're the person that's making the decisions, and you can decide things that are much more effective for your family than – the cookie cutter that you would get from a judge.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. You go into the court process, a judge has limits to what they are able to do as far as making a determination of how to divide up assets or how to set future cash flow for child and spousal support and things of that nature. If you go into a collaborative process, a negotiated process, that ultimate decision is up to the parties. And they can do whatever they want as long as it passes the sniff test and they've had professional advice to get there.
That's a really good point. I mean, I've seen Justin actually come into a case, and because the clients have a certain goal that they want to achieve that may be outside of the scope of what a judge would be able to do, he can be very creative because of his financial training to help them come up with plans that are really going to be better for him.
We are on with Sean Weber. He is a family law attorney here with Brave Weber Mac, or Brave Weber and Mac, but the website, bravewebermac.com, as well as Justin Retkers. He is the managing director of Pacific Divorce Management. The website is packdivorce.com, going through the 20 biggest concerns for people contemplating a separation. And they've boiled them down to 20, although I suspect, like you said, Justin, there are well over 100. We don't have time to get through all those, but go to their website. You can pick up all the information. It's all right there. We talked briefly as a collaborative solution. Briefly, what are the other solutions that are out there?
Well, another solution would be mediation, and that's where you hire a neutral mediator who can sit with the parties and help them reach a resolution. They usually have training to facilitate negotiation, to facilitate discussion in a way that's, it's in a non-threatening environment, and it helps the parties reach an agreement. And I've done a lot of mediations in my career. I've done a lot more mediations. I have collaborative, and I've had people tell me at the end of a mediation, wow, we communicated better with you in the mediation sessions than we did after 30 years of marriage.
And so collaborative mediation, and then, of course, court, full on.
You can litigate. And then there's also, there's the kitchen table.
Right.
A lot of people do this on their own. And maybe they want to hire someone like me or Justin to kind of help them through that process. Maybe they have a good idea of what they want to do, but they just have some questions. We can help in that respect as well.
It's interesting to contemplate that there are multiple ways. It makes sense now that you say it, but something I hadn't thought about, that there are multiple ways to get through the divorce process. We have, again, Sean Weber here and Justin Rutgers going through the 20 biggest concerns for people contemplating a separation. When we come back, we're going to continue with the 19 remaining of our 20-point test. So happy it's Thursday. Welcome. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. In studio with us today, Justin Rutgers. He is the Managing Director of Pacific Divorce Management. Thank you again, Justin.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And Sean Weber, the Love Doctor, family law attorney with Brave, Weber, and Mac.
You know I'm not really a doctor, right?
Well, you are to me, Sean.
What's love got to do with it, right?
You are to me.
Right, right.
We are going through the 20 biggest concerns people might have when contemplating a separation. We got through one of them, and through the break, kind of sounds like we may have even skipped a little bit of that. Sean brought to my attention that a really important question to ask your attorney is, do they offer options? Because apparently not all family law attorneys allow for multiple divorce options.
Yeah, I think a big warning sign if you go into an attorney's office and they tell you, well, we're just going to file at court and that's it. That's a big warning sign. You need to ask them, do you offer alternate dispute resolution? That's a technical term that means outside of court options, no court options. If they don't offer anything like that, then you need to ask them why, and you probably need to run for the door.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of sounds like court is the worst, least favorite, most expensive way about
doing this. Well, yeah, I had a professor in law school that used to say that court was like litigation was like a meat grinder. You go in a pig, you come out a sausage.
Yikes.
And that's really true. If you want to be miserable, if you want to ruin your day, go over to the family court and just sit in the lobby and watch people.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds awesome.
Seriously.
I think it is still important to note that there's a very small percentage of divorce cases that literally go through a trial similar to what you would see in some sort of a dramatic replay in a movie. There's a very, very small percentage. Would you say, Sean, less than probably 5% of all divorce cases would really go to a trial?
I think that's right, because yeah. It's actually irrational to go to a trial because of the amount of cost that there is. It's really much more rational to try to settle.
That actually brings up a good point. I mean, we talked about the three different options, and there may be more. Four, you actually said the kitchen table is one of them. So would you say that the level of complication with regards to the separation and ultimately the divorce is a determining factor with regard to which option you choose?
I think that's a big determining factor. The level of complication could be a factor of, are you going to decide between mediation or kitchen table or collaborative? Collaborative is really made to order for the cases where maybe there's some financial issues that are difficult to understand or difficult to sort out. I wouldn't say, though, that complication equals let's go to court or lots of money equals we've got to go to court. I think what differentiates between the out-of-court options and we have to go to court options is that, things like the level of trust between the parties, how much are they able to work together, the level of functioning that they have on a, for lack of a better word, psychological level.
Well, for the collaborative divorce, it sounds like trust is a big part of that.
Yeah, I mean, trust but verify. So that's why the disclosure rules are the same in collaborative as they would be in court. You still have to disclose everything. But, yeah, you have to be able to sit in a room with a person and be able to work through things. And if you can't do that, then maybe litigation is a better option.
Well, and the good thing about a collaborative process when it comes to trust, a lot of things are around money issues. And in collaborative process, you have a financial professional who will go and get information as well as accept information from the parties. So the Trust But Verify is there, but also has somebody looking into it and doing informal gathering of data.
Yeah, I would say that's the Verify.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I tell you, Ryan and I run into this all the time. People are getting a divorce. They're selling their house, whatever situation happens to be. And we've noticed that it seems like all roads lead to you, Justin, right? I mean, you're the guy who actually does this, in a sense, forensic analysis. And when it comes to collaborative divorce, what happens if someone's not necessarily being all that truthful with regards to their financial situation?
Well, you're right, David. If people don't have children, then the only thing they have to argue about in a divorce is money. So, yes, you might say that in some circumstances, someone like myself who knows financial products and knows tracing of assets and things of that nature is absolutely paramount to have involved. So when it comes to digging up data, though, in a collaborative process, for instance, if somebody is not freely giving, then there are two ways that things go. Either we decide as a team, the collaborative team, that there's something wrong, and that we need to either stop the process or abort the process because somebody's not playing fair, or myself or someone like me will go and get information from a third-party source, go directly to a bank, go directly to an accountant, things of that nature to get the information that we're lacking.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear to me that with this reduced amount of questions, this frequently asked questions, we're down to 20 or so. We're touching on a few of them. And there's just so many questions that are coming up. I got to say, we're not going to get to all 20 of these. If you have questions, give us a call. The hotline is 888-551-2593. Leave a message. We'll have Justin Reckers or Sean Weber get back to you regarding, you know, a situation that you may have. Again, the hotline is 888-551-2593. That's the number.
So you guys were talking a lot about trust, which I think brings us to number two, the discovery. And where is the information, and do you trust the other, I guess, your partner?
Yeah, I think that number two could actually kind of be combined with another item. So that really, where is the information? Do I trust my spouse? Do I trust my financial advisor, my accountant, so on and so forth? Sometimes you get a couple where one party has had the relationship with the financial advisor and the accountant, and the other one has just kind of signed things when they were put in front of them. So that outside party may not have any trust or even any relationship with that financial advisor or an accountant, and they'll immediately say, I don't trust them. We need to dig into what they're doing. So the first questions that a lawyer or anybody like me should be asking a client is, do we trust the sources of data? Do you think there are places where stuff might be hidden that we have to dig up? And that will inform any discovery process from a financial perspective as it moves forward.
And this is a real key. I don't care which process you're engaged in. The law is very clear in any kind of divorce that you have to have full disclosure of everything, all material facts and data, whether it's asked for or not. And so, and the courts, they can do all kinds of mean things to people that don't disclose. So, invariably I'll get some client that'll try to do some, you know, silly stuff where they try to hide things or play games. And I guarantee you they're not as sophisticated as Justin. He'll be able to figure it out. And what ends up happening is they end up causing more problems and more harm than good. And so disclosure is really something that I'm always preaching to my clients, and good attorneys do that. If you have an attorney that's telling you how to hide your assets, that's another reason to run for the door.
Yeah, and I think the second piece of what we were talking about there too is another one of our, you know, our concerns for people is if you fail to overturn every stone and investigate every concern that you have, especially regarding finances and a dissolution, there's a very good chance that you will regret the decisions that you made. Because you'll come back to always wondering whether you missed something or wondering whether you did the work necessary to really answer all of your questions and allay all of your fears.
Yeah. On the other side of that same coin, though, it's really hard to prove a negative.
Sure.
You know, invariably you'll have the out spouse. Well, I know he's got money or she's got money hidden somewhere. How does that guy prove that he doesn't have money hidden somewhere? Because you can't provide a statement that says, I don't have money hidden. And so at some point, you know, there is a point where, yeah, I have uncovered every stone and really it's not there. And if it is there, I'm not going to find it. And then that person needs to make a decision.
Well, and that's another key thing to think about, is that at some point, the law of diminishing returns needs to dictate what somebody does in this process. If you spend years of life and hundreds of thousands of dollars digging into financial data that's 15, 20 years old, the law of diminishing returns might tell you that you've spent too much because it's not worth what you're going to find. And as Sean said, there might not be a negative answer to it. It might be that we can't tell you 100% that there isn't money missing because we can't go outside of the United States or something.
You know, that's a good point. That law of diminishing returns may actually play into that role where people say, let's just be fair, you know, for the sake of getting it done. And they just sort of turn over and, you know, give the keys over and just say, whatever, I'll sign anything. And you know, it's just an important situation. Do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the let's just get it done kind of thing always comes at the end of the process, obviously. You know, after a couple, 3 years of fighting it out in a court or in any sort of format, when you're down to kind of the horse trading, I call it, at the end of the process, and it's $10,000 or $1,000 here and there, and you just kind of give in on that last issue for the sake of getting it done and getting it out of your life and getting it over with.
I can see that. We're on with Justin Rutgers, Managing Director of Pacific Divorce Management, the website PAC Divorce, going over his 20-point list of concerns for people contemplating a separation. We've made it through now three of them, maybe three and a half, on our way to all 20. For more information, go to Justin's website, PAC Divorce, PACDivorce.com, or Sean's website, BraveWeberMac.com. And when we come back, we will continue on with the remaining 16 and a half.
Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday, the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Ryan White.
And myself, Big Mac David McKelvin. We are on live with Justin Rutgers, Managing Director with Pacific Divorce Management. Welcome, Justin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Seems like all roads lead to Justin, and we've definitely covered a number of things here. And we also have Sean Weber, the Love Doctor, on with us. Welcome, Sean.
Glad to be here.
Well, you know, I think one of the big things that people are talking about these days is the word fair. I mean, is it really fair when we divide assets? Is there such a thing?
In a word, no. I try to divest all of my clients of notions of fairness. You know, when we're kids, we grow up thinking, oh, well, that's not fair, or that's fair, and we want everything to be fair. But the trouble is, when you're going to a court situation, fair is not really what we're looking for. We'd like it to be fair, but it's just not a realistic expectation. That lady that you see at the courthouse with the scales of justice, she doesn't really exist. She's a figment. And the judge is certainly not concerned about fair. He's just concerned about applying the law. And the law is not always fair. And so it's difficult when people want to just want to have the fair deal. The other thing that Justin brought up during the break is that not everybody has the same perception of what fair means.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, when you're helping a husband and a wife go through the process of dissolving a marriage, they each are going to have completely different ideas of what's financially fair for how to shake out the asset division and the income and expenses and things going forward. And part of the collaborative process or any negotiated settlement that you do that you don't get in a litigated model in court is that you can actually get to the bottom of each person's definition of fair and help them understand where those ideas match and where they don't match, which will help them get to a point where they negotiate a settlement.
Really, it's about making a good business decision.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the largest financial transaction of most people's lives, and it's set during emotional chaos, and without kind of objective guidance from people, you run the risk of making some kind of economically irrational decisions.
I can see how the definition of fair would change drastically from one person to another. That makes a lot of sense. And getting down to what each person thinks is fair and having them vocalize that, that's rough. That does not seem like an easy thing to do.
Right. So instead of asking yourself the question, well, is this deal fair? And maybe I'm lowering people's expectations, but I think it's important to be realistic. Is this a deal that I can live with? You know, is it fair? Maybe not. But is it a deal I can live with? Am I going to be able to take this deal and live the rest of my life and be okay?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what the average marriage is. Some 7 years kind of jumps out at me, but obviously there are shorter and longer divorces. But relationships, obviously, with the combined income and the cost of living around here, with the combined income of dual income, you acquire things. such as real estate, and you invest in 401ks, and you begin to live the dream that you planned when you got married. And a lot of times you end up with this situation where now you may not be able to afford to continue with the house after everything is all said and done, And yet, somebody might say, well, geez, I want to stay here. I want to keep the kids in the same school district. What is it? What happens when, people say they want to keep the residence that they may not be able to afford?
Well, you're absolutely right, David. The cliche of divorce settlements from back in the 60s and in some places still today is the wife keeps the house, the husband keeps the pension. And with no regard whatsoever for whether that makes financial sense for either one of them. That was just kind of the way it went. And nowadays, I think that people are becoming more aware of the fact that they need to make sure they can afford to keep that house long term. They can afford to pay the mortgage, pay the property taxes, and they're not going to be put into a position where they have to pull up the floorboards in the living room to throw them in the fireplace in order to heat the place because they can't pay their gas bill.
Well, it's true. I can't tell you how many – we used to think that our average – our client was someone between the age of 30 and 45 that was a recent divorcee that may have gotten the property in the divorce and either couldn't afford it or they wanted to do a short sale now.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've been seeing very recently a lot is couples who are agreeing to co-own a house after their divorce for the sake of maybe keeping their kids in the same school or just because they thought it wasn't the right time to sell or something like that. And even if you continue to co-own that residence, it still can be a very bad financial decision for both parties because eventually you run the risk of putting yourself in a position where you have no choice but to sell at a bad time because other financial circumstances come to the fore and it forces your hand.
There's a cliche, another cliche, it's cheaper to keep her.
I'm sure they might be the other way. It's cheaper to keep him.
But the point is, when you have a divorce, or let me rephrase that, when you're married, you're able to pool resources. You're able to specialize your tasks. Maybe somebody stays home with the kids and the other person goes out and works. And this specialization of tasks and this working together thing creates more wealth. That's the point of a family. But when you have the husband and wife splitting up and now they're going to live in separate homes.
Yeah, some might say they've doubled up on their mortgage payments.
Correct.
And then now they're taking the kids from one place to another. Scheduling. I mean, in fact, divorcing may actually mean that life is now way more expensive, way more complicated, and people are looking at all aspects of this.
Both
situation.
Of them are going to experience a reduction in their standard of living.
We're on with Sean Weber with Brave Weber and Mack, family law attorney, going through their 20 concerns for people contemplating a divorce. Can be found on the website again, bravewebermack.com, talking about, does it make sense to keep the house? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Justin, you brought up the fact that people are opting to co-own even after separation. I would think that's a pretty large emotional strain. How often does that work?
Well, I think that it's become a little bit more frequent now, given the downtrend in the real estate markets that we had in the second half of the early 2000s. And they had two reasons. One, for the sake of the kids staying in the home and continuing to go to the same schools. And two, for reasons that they either couldn't afford to sell it because they were underwater or because it just made more financial sense to hold it and let the value rebound, right? So when people make decisions like that, my experience is they often aren't thinking about the long term. They're thinking about the short term and trying to limit the amount of effects that they're having upon their kids, which is a valiant thing to do and a very nice thing to do as parents to try and protect your children from change. But ultimately, if it turns into a failed plan, it's going to hurt them worse. So I usually try and help people get away from that kind of a decision-making process. And also have to understand in co-ownership, you have to worry about who's responsible for paying what and whether something's maintenance or repairs, all those kind of things come into play too.
I can see that. We find that often when we're talking to a client about a short sale, which appears to be kind of going away, but in years past we were talking about that. It was commonly because of a divorce. They didn't want to sell the house. They could afford it as long as they were married, but when they separate and they're already upside down, they can no longer afford it. A unique thing to point out is the divorce is one of the reasons that most lenders will consider a true hardship and will allow most of the time that to go through. It's not what one would consider to be a strategic divorce, which they tend to frown on. It is something they tend to let go through. And now we're seeing Chase give away as much as 45, $45,000.
Yeah, I know.
I heard today, $45,000 giving away on occasion to successfully process a short sale, which was news to me.
It is somewhat a mystery as to how they come up with exactly how much they're going to give somebody when they do the short sale. But I got to say that, you know, it's almost like cash for keys, only not a foreclosure. And a lot of people think to themselves, how in the world am I going to reestablish myself? And, you know, the banks have finally used some of the money that they've gotten to facilitate the short sale, to incentivize the process. In fact, I mean, $45,000 to short sale a property, and it may be that in the height of the market that the house didn't have $45,000 worth of equity in it. Yes.
Yeah, commonly it didn't.
That's up and above commissions.
Sounds like a good way to fund legal fees for divorcing couples.
Well, those were the good old days before everything kind of blew up in 2008. We divorce attorneys were saying, well, we'll always get paid out of the house when the house sells, and then that kind of flipped on its head.
Right.
It flipped for all of us.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we used to not have to calculate equity when we went out and interviewed to sell a house, and now you know it's one of the first thing you do to make sure that there is not a short sale situation, so you can prepare for that conversation if it has to take place about, you know, it looks like this is short.
Well, we talked about dividing up the house, and we briefly touched on dividing up a retirement plan. But you had mentioned a qualified domestic relations order.
Yeah, what is that?
Well, retirement plans such as a 401k, an IRA, those type of things are governed by federal law that effectively says that you cannot take money out of that account and give it to an alternate payee. It has to be the person who's on the title of the account and that person only. The only way you can change that is by drafting and filing a qualified domestic relations order, which is a legal document informing the plan that they need to pay some of those funds to someone else, in this case, the former spouse. And oftentimes those are done during the course of the divorce proceedings. They should be done that way and be filed at the same time an agreement is. But what's a big risk is when people don't get them done and they wait 2, 3, 4 years after the proceedings are over to actually try and go get their money. And then funds have moved from one account to another. The employee might have gone to a different employer. And there's all kinds of different places where you can create complications that weren't expected.
We're on with Justin Rutgers, Managing Director of Pacific Divorce Management, PacDivorce.com. The helpline here, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. Or go to his website, again, PacDivorce.com. Going over his list of the 20 biggest concerns for people contemplating a separation.
So say somebody files this qualified domestic relations order, and whether it be he or her gets, you know, access to the 401k that they were part of during the divorce, because there's a goalpost, right? There's the beginning of the divorce and there's the end. So when it ends, that's when the line is drawn in the sand and that asset is divided equally. So does the new person get their name on the 401k, or are they able to self-direct that? I mean, what is it remain where it is? I mean, tell me more about that.
Well, good and complicated question. step one is you can actually divide these things before the dissolution is over. It just requires a legal process for people to agree to pre-distribution of funds and things of that nature. So if you have a reason for needing liquidity, for instance, you can negotiate in a collaborative process or in a mediated setting to do things like that. In a litigated setting, it's more difficult. In a litigated setting, where what would likely happen is that somebody would take the money out of a plan and it would become immediately taxable. So it's ordinary income taxes, plus if you're under 59 and a half years old, you got to pay an additional 10% penalty. So when this quadro, though, for instance, is done, what happens is the plan administrator will take funds out of the initial plan, the account, who's in, say it's in wife's name, take the money out of wife's account, and they'll open a new account in the husband's name and transfer it over there. Usually that will be in the form of an IRA account, as the plan administrators don't usually like to have non-employee account holders. So it'll go from a 401k account into an IRA account, and yes, they can self-direct that. I would suggest that they go seek whoever, either party really should have a financial advisor, but the person who's getting distributions via a quadro should seek investment advice, financial advisory advice to help them determine what they're going to do with those funds and manage them adequately, or else they'll just be left and forgotten.
You know, and I got to agree, seeking the advice is key, because if you don't make the right decisions, this is something that could have huge financial impacts later. You got to make sure you're going with both of your eyes wide open.
And so meeting with someone like Justin, meeting with an attorney, and going over, okay, how am I going to do this division of this pension in a way that's not going to screw me up later on, is really key.
We're on with Justin Ruchters, Managing Director of Pacific Divorce Management, and Sean Weber, family law attorney with Brave, Weber, and Mack. When we come back, looks like we have about 7 remaining topics. We might get through the majority of them, which surprises me. When we come back, we'll continue on with the remaining 7.
Welcome back to the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Ryan White,
and myself, Big Mac, David McKelvin. We are on with Sean Weber. Sean Weber, with world-renowned family law attorney with Brave, Weber, and Mack. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Justin Ruchters, the Managing Director of Pacific Divorce Management at PACDivorce.com. You know, we talked a little bit about this Qualified Domestic Relations Order, which is the legal document that you file to separate some of the assets, such as 401ks.
That's correct, David. Retirement accounts. Just think of it that way. Pensions, retirement accounts.
You got it. And so, you know, one of the things we talked on earlier when we first started the show here was the fact that when you step into a divorce attorney's office, there are some things you should ask them. And one of them is, do you have options when it comes to divorce?
That's right. I mean, you need to ask him or her, what options do you have? If it's just, I'm going to file a petition for dissolution, I'm going to be a litigating attorney, that's a danger sign. That means that they're not going to be willing to consider other options that could be cheaper and maybe better for the family. There's so much about a divorce that's emotional, that involves the family, that can be really destructive if you just only offer the litigated model.
I think it also kind of foreshadows another thing or another personality trait about that attorney, and that's the lack of being able to be dynamic. And an attorney who can operate successfully in multiple forms of dissolution proceedings obviously has to have the skill to be dynamic in the way that they operate in order to be successful in those different modes. And somebody who's not able to operate in different forms might lack that ability to be dynamic, which is also a negative in the world of negotiation. You know, you have to be able to really look at your different scenarios and different options and keep your mind open and be dynamic in negotiations.
That's really important. You want to avoid the cookie cutter approach to a divorce. I mean, this is your life. You wouldn't want somebody to apply cookie cutter to your life. But there are attorneys where they're very formulaic and very one-dimensional in the way that they think. And if they're not willing to be flexible to make the process work for the individual instead of the other way around, then that's a warning sign.
You know, Justin, you're often called on to speak to attorneys in a lot of cases. And I'm looking at an outline that you wrote here. And so some of these options for proceedings, you've got avoid, always, and avoid here. What are some of the topics that you should avoid?
Well, so avoid retaining an attorney before considering all your options, as we've discussed before. I often have an individual or a couple who will come to me before having seen a lawyer, and I will go through with them their various options for proceeding and dissolution proceedings, just kind of an educational overview, pros and cons of the different possible options, possible costs versus possible benefits, things of that nature. I do also always say, consider alternative dispute resolution, such as a collaborative or mediation type process for purposes of going through a divorce. It's more functional, more effective for the long-term health of a family, and it makes it more possible for people to have self-determination involved in their decision-making rather than have someone else make the decisions for them. And then I also always say avoid choosing a divorce process based upon the estimated cost. So the cookie cutter, as Sean said, or divorce mill type place where you can get divorced online or over the telephone, or I've seen a van in Mission Valley with a sign that says $600 divorce or something like that. Those kind of things are not going to give you the advice, guidance, and understanding that you need to truly be able to understand your rights and responsibilities in the process.
I really like those vans and things like that, because what they do is they make a lot of money for me in undoing the mistakes that were made for the parties.
Yeah, it seems to me like that's a lost leader. You know, it's too good to be true. You know, they just want you to make that call, and then when you do, they may upsell you to something more like a traditional divorce, because it's really refreshing to hear what you say, Justin, because it sounds so not self-serving. You know, when you discuss, you know, avoid retaining an attorney before considering all options, right? You know, someone walks in your office, which, by the way, you know, you had mentioned that you're willing to give 30 minutes of free consultation. So if somebody has any questions that we've gone over, and it sounds to me like a lot of people come to you before they actually choose an attorney to really see what the options are available to them. And, you know, you said always consider alternative dispute resolutions such as collaborative divorce or mediation, which, you know, seems a little anti, I'm going to go make a bunch of money because now I've retained you as a client to do a full-on divorce. And avoid choosing a divorce process based on the estimated cost, you know? You know, when we're talking about avoiding deciding financial issues, which is piecemealing instead of understanding the big picture, so tell me more about piecemealing versus understanding the big picture when it comes to divorce.
I think there's a couple pieces to the piecemeal issue. Excuse me. And that's some people will negotiate in a way where they try and divide and conquer. So they'll take one issue at a time and try and win on each individual issue rather than looking at the global settlement and making sure that they all can interconnect with one another. So my personal advice to people is to make sure that they understand the large picture, the global picture of all of their financial situation, how they are all interconnected, assets, liabilities, incomes, expenses, they all can have an effect upon one another. And if you don't look at them as a whole, a piecemeal negotiation might leave you having forgotten something.
We're on with Justin Rutgers, Pacific Divorce Management, going over his 20 biggest concerns for people contemplating a separation, and you were just talking about the big picture versus piecemealing them, and that's really one of the reasons someone would come talk to you, so you can take a look at the big picture. That's kind of your thing.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, the details of financial pictures for people, you'd be amazed how many couples, or at least pieces of that couple, have really no clue where their money is, how they get paid, how much they get paid, how much goes into their 401k, how much taxes they pay or how to avoid taxes. My job really is to help people understand the details, level the playing field in alternative dispute resolution worlds so that everybody has the same information, including the legal advisors, the lawyers in the process, and all the details are brought to the fore so that everybody can make completely informed decisions.
I can't tell you times I've referred someone to someone like Justin, get some financial advice. Let's talk about the budget. And they're like, well, you're my attorney. Can't you help me with that? And I want to tell them, you got to understand, I went to law school. I didn't get an MBA. I'm not a financial advisor. I know the law, but I'm not a financial planner. You need somebody like Justin who can help you with the financial planning. And the good lawyers will utilize someone like Justin to give their clients a better product.
Yeah, the details are important, too, and what we talked about before, which is someone's idea of fair. If we don't know the details of their idea of fair, we can never really give them that ideal scenario. So getting to the details of things is really important, and as a financial professional, certainly in the world of finances, that's my job, understanding financial products, incomes, cash flows, things like that, and then making sure that I have a wonderful lawyer like Sean Weber here to work with to help me relate that information to the party that I'm working with.
Another guarantee I can make is the judge doesn't understand the finances either.
That's interesting to think about. Judge doesn't get it, huh?
They're not financial people. In general, a lot of them think they are, but they don't. They're not financial people. They're relying on someone to tell them what the finances are supposed to be. So even in a litigated case, it's a good idea to have somebody who's a financial professional involved so that you can communicate to the judge. Because just because you've told your story at court doesn't mean that the judge is going to get it.
Yeah, I remember you talking about that before. That's an interesting point because the assumption is made that you get there and you tell your story, the judge is going to get it.
Yeah, they're going to get it right. I mean, they may not get it right at all.
Yeah, so many people. If I go into court and I tell the judge my story, he's going to see it my way. I've had people tell me that, and really that's not the case very often. It's the judge is simply there to apply
late,
the law.
Right? He
it's
says,
too
it's,
late by
this
then.
Is
yeah.
it. You know, this is it. He makes his judgment, and that's it.
You really got maybe 5-10 minutes to get your side out with a judge a lot of times, and
That's what seems to be a real upside with a collaborative divorce, because you can actually pre-decide, and you may decide, hey, I'm going to allow you to have that. I'm going to keep this and pre-agree.
Correct. Why would you let a stranger in Black Roads decide where your kids live, for instance?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. So, you know, it seems to me that with this CDFA, Justin, that attorneys are coming to you and saying, hey, I'm working with some clients here. We're going to work out some resolution, and we need you to do the discovery behind this financial situation.
Yeah, so discovery would be the first piece of it. So oftentimes I get calls from from attorneys who want me to help do kind of cost-benefit analysis on making a financial argument with regards to claiming some separate property or claiming that someone's income is what it is. And I will help them kind of do some risk-reward analysis and some cost-benefit analysis on how to put on their case. And also I will help to inform the client that they are working with about the process, about the financial decisions that are going to be made, and hopefully that they're going to be making them for themselves rather than the judge, so that I can help manage that that kind of financial data gathering, as you said, at the discovery, to make sure that we're putting it across to the other side in a way that's easily understood as well.
Well, gentlemen, it looks like we made it through about 14 of the 20. I got check marks all over my sheet of paper here, leaving six out there. Again, that's Justin Ruckers, Pacific Divorce Management. Go to his website, packdivorce.com, for the entire list. And Sean Weber, world-renowned family law attorney, Brave Weber and Mac, the website, bravewebermac.com. Both of them giving away free consultation, half-hour consultation for anybody that may have struggles along the divorce process. Again, the website, packdivorce.com, bravewebermac.com. The helpline here, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. And coming up next, it's Sports Court with Tim Stromble.